Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and today we'll be taking a stroll down memory lane with Jeffrey Bloom, who will be recalling bars from Boston, including Punch Bowl, Jacques Cabaret, and Napoleon. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And you don't know how much I appreciate some of the stories you're about to tell. You're a Boston native, is that correct?
That's correct.
And in the early years, you have some experience with some iconic bars that existed in Boston. One that is of particular interest to me was a bar that was known as the Punch Bowl.
That's correct.
And the Punch Bowl, if my research is correct, was located in Park Square.
Correct.
And it was right on the street. It was not like so many other gay bars back then that were hidden and painted dark colors with no signage and a rear entrance. This was like a grand dam of a movie theater sitting right on the street with a big neon sign over the top saying, "Here we are."
That's right. There was a neon sign. It was you could walk through the front door. Most of the gay bars at that point, in Boston or anywhere else, the front windows were all blacked out, and you went through the back through an alley. This particular bar, as you said, was in Park Square, very visible, front door entrance, and a big neon sign announcing its existence that said the Punch Bowl. So, you know, you couldn't miss it. It was definitely one of the buildings that was in Park Square. Park Square at that point, there was the Punch Bowl, and then in Park Square, there was also Hayes Bickford, which was a coffee shop. So, and Hayes Bickford was a place before or after the Punch Bowl where all the gay boys would gather. It was sort of a gathering place. And it was a mishmash of gay boys, drag queens, street hustlers, whatever. So that was just sort of an epicenter. Park Square, that whole area in the late 50s and through the beginning of the 60s was sort of the epicenter of gay life, nightlife in Boston.
Now, I understand the Punch Bowl was opened in 1944. Do you know if at that time it was opened as a gay bar?
That, I do not know. I know that when I arrived in 64, it had been open for, I think, at least a decade before as a gay bar. I don't know about in the 40s what it was. I have no, don't have that history, no.
Now, what was the physical space like there? Was it a big bar inside and lavish, or was it very simple and plain?
It wasn't lavish. You walked in, and there was like a center bar in the center of the space. As I recall, it was a circular bar that went around. It was medium-sized, and it was, I wouldn't say it was a spare space. It was comfortable, but it wasn't really very fancy. I don't remember, except for the bar, parts of the bar had stools. The rest of the space upstairs, you just stood. You stood around. And I believe, as I recall, around the walls, they had like little shelving where you could put your beer and put your drinks and stuff like that. But everybody stood. And there was a jukebox off to one side. Of course, this was before the days of DJs and mixing and all of that stuff. And you just plunked your money into the jukebox. And it kept on playing all the time because people were always wanting to listen to the music. The first time I went in, I had a fake ID, which I got. I was just going to turn 18, but I hadn't quite turned 18. And the first, I just remember this one particular image very clearly. When I walked in, there was this really good looking, preppy, Ivy League looking guy, boy. But he had pancake makeup on his face, and his eyebrows were sort of not penciled in. They were his eyebrows, but he had like eyebrow pencil on it. And I just remember being really shocked when I saw that. I had never seen anything like that before. Being there the first time, it was jaw-dropping. Because growing up, I had one other friend. We went in together. I had a friend that I've known, I still am very close with, that I've known since I was 13 years old. And he was gay also. We discovered that we were both homosexuals at that point. I mean, in high school and everything. So we went in together. And I just remember having this experience where I thought that he and I were the only two. Who knew that there was this other world? And it was, even though the punch bowl was very visible, it still had a demi-monde kind of feel to it. It was still kind of secretive. I mean, when you went in, after I went the first time and then I started going, always looked around left, right before entering to see if there was anybody around. So it still had kind of a secret cachet about it. I'm sure that most people that lived in Boston around that era knew it was a gay bar, because what would happen is a lot of the straight guys or fraternity boys or people from the North End or South Beach, they would come and pick up gay boys to have them service them and then usually beat them up afterwards. That was a major thing that was going on then too.
So keeping in mind that this was 4 or 5 years before Stonewall, when you were first experiencing the punch bowl, was there anything special about as you entered? Was it a membership only bar, or did they have a lot of security at the door, or how did they filter keeping people out that would cause trouble in the bar?
There was no membership. You could walk in, but there was the bouncer, who was this big mafioso guy. I always saw him as mafioso. And he sort of controlled who could enter and who didn't enter. And if there was anybody that looked like they were trouble, he would not allow them to come in. You had to show your ID, to make sure you were legal age to get in. But that was about it. No security, nothing like that at all. No membership. Now, later on, when they would have, I think I talked to you about this, when they would have the what were called the red sweater parties on Sunday, because the punch bowl had a downstairs area too. I think in the beginning, before they had the red sweater parties, it was a storage place for liquor and whatever. And then they cleaned that all out, and they made it into a dance floor. There was a dance floor downstairs and a jukebox. And the thing is that you had to wear a red sweater. On Sundays, you could come in and just be upstairs. But if you didn't wear a red sweater, you were not allowed to go downstairs to dance at the red sweater party.
And that was decades before the red shirt concept at Disney. That we're talking the middle to late 60s.
Yeah, I don't think, the red shirt at Disney World when they had gay Disney, I don't think there was any connection. I think whoever thought up the theme of the party, that they just called it a red sweater party, maybe because red was a gay color. Way back, and I don't know if you know this about gay history, one of the signals, or one of the codes, this is probably more in New York, I think, in the West Village and stuff, is if a gentleman wore a red necktie, that was a code that he was gay. That was one of the signs.
Oh, very cool. So Now Boston, at that time, did you feel like Boston was somewhat accepting of the gay community, or was it still pretty taboo, but that particular location and a couple of bars nearby were kind of safe places for you to go?
Yeah, as far as I knew, I mean, I didn't really know, you know, in 64, if there was a large gay community. I found out, you know, in years, in the next 3 years, that there was a large gay community. It wasn't really organized. It was just the bars were the place, was the community. That's where people would go, one of the places that people would go to meet each other and become friends and, you know, build relationships, friendships, or partners and stuff like that. It was all through the bars or maybe on the streets. I mean, there was also a cafe. I think it was on Summer Street. I'm not sure. Called Joe's Cafe. And on Beacon Hill, there was also a coffee shop called Sheriff's. That was a gay hangout. People would go and hang out and have coffee. They served, you know, food, and everybody, it was gay. It was the clientele was completely gay. So that was another meeting place. And of course, Hayes Pickford, as I told you, which was a little bit sleazier, but it was still a meeting place. So there was the Punch Bowl, and the other bar, the other major bar, was Sporters, which was in, at that point, called Scully Square. It's where the government center is now, but then it was Scully Square. And Sporters, as I recall, they had no security. You could just walk in, and it was just a bar. There was no dancing or anything, and again, a jukebox. So those were the two major bars that you would go back and forth between, or that I went back and forth between, was the Punch Bowl and Sporters. Sporters has been open, was open for a long time, and I think, and you probably know, I don't know if it's still open, but it had a long, long life. It went all the way through the 90s, I believe.
Now, Punch Bowl, other than when you went downstairs for the red sweater party, was there any dancing upstairs, or was that just a socializing space? Or
no, upstairs was total socializing.
And there was no dancing
upstairs. You have to remember also that it was illegal for two men to dance together in those days. You'd get arrested. That's why the mafia, they paid off the cops. And so on Sunday, even though we were dancing, we were really, it was a risky situation because it was illegal for two men to be dancing together. If they had a raid, there was this thing that they had a light bulb in the ceiling. And when the light bulb went on, you had to, if you were with somebody or you were being affectionate with somebody, you had to separate. Because that meant that the police were coming. They were coming in to either check IDs. I don't remember the Punch Bowl ever being raided, but they definitely came in.
Now the Punch
Bowl, the light bulb going on, a harsh white light bulb, was the signal that they were coming.
The Punch Bowl was originally owned by a man who was very well known in Boston for owning quite a number of bars. His name was Henry Vera. And as we mentioned earlier, the Punch Bowl opened in 1944, but 6 years before that, he opened another bar that was not too far from there, which was called the Colonial Tavern. And the Colonial Tavern operated for a couple of years, mostly servicing people who worked in the men who worked in the manufacturing industry during the day. But at night, it transitioned into attracting a gay clientele somehow. And from the stories that I've read, in just a couple of years after Colonial Tavern opened, they renamed it Jacques.
Jacques.
And,
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
And rumor is that the reason that the Veras opened up Punch Bowl was because they saw the great success they were having with Jacques attracting gay clientele and having an incredible amount of business, and they decided that a second location would be a good idea to tap into that market as well. Now,
like I said, they probably saw it. I mean, it was, and they knew that gay bars in those days were cash cows because they already had a completely captured clientele, demographic. I mean, there was no place else a gay man could gather together and be together except a gay bar. That was sort of the epicenter. That was the meeting place. And so, like you said, with the jocks, if that ended up being a very successful business for them, and they probably had very little overhead, that they figured, well, if one is good enough, two or three might be even better. And so that's probably how that all came about, you know. As far as the Punch Bowl, when you said it was opened in the 40s, that probably was a place where sailors might have gone and gay sailors, who knows? And it was a pickup place for sailors, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all.
And because the sailors, I mean, you know about the combat zone in Boston, correct?
Right.
Okay. So the combat zone was definitely a place where you would pick up sailors. The sailors would go to the combat zone. There was a movie theater there. Lots of dirty doings going on in the movie theater. And so that was another place for gay people to kind of, you know, meet. And also the Greyhound bus station was a very cruisy place for gays as well. But the main, I have to just divert for a second. The main, and this is sort of what the schedule was for me anyways. You would go to, first of all, you would start out your Saturday night at Hayes Bickford. You would meet a lot of your friends there, maybe like around 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock on a Saturday night. And, you know, you would get a bite to eat and you'd meet your friends. And then after that, starting around 10:30 or 11, or no, actually before that. So after Hayes Bickford, you would go down to Sporters. This would be around 9 or 10 o'clock and you'd spend like an hour or two at Sporters. And then you would end up for the rest of the evening at the Punch Bowl, which was open till 2 o'clock, I believe. And then after that, you would go maybe back to Hayes Bickford. But if you wanted to have some kind of sexual rendezvous, you would go to across from the Boston Gardens. We used to call it the Row, R-O-W. It was right in front of the Ritz-Carlton, and it was a place that would go down Newbury Street and around, and cars would circle and circle and circle, and you would just stand on the sidewalk, or if you had a car, be in a car, and you would pick, you know, a boy up or something like that, or a partner to have sex with. And that went on, you know, into 2-3 o'clock in the morning.
Now, you've mentioned Sporters a couple of times. What was Sporters like? What was the ambiance? What was the bar like?
It was a very, very friendly bar. And it was a small bar. I remember it being sort of a narrow more than wide, the jukebox at the end and a bar. And it was just, I don't know if it was mainly really a pickup bar. I remember it being very social, drinking lots of beer. It was very lighthearted, lots of laughter, lots of just, it was really a happy place to go. And I never felt, for some reason, I don't know why, but I never felt intimidated in that bar. I felt safe there for some reason. Now, I don't know if who owned that bar, if it was a mafia owned bar or whatever, but it was my favorite. Actually, in a way, except for the red sweater parties, I really enjoyed Sporters more because I knew a lot of people. I had a lot of friends that would go there. So we would go and hang out, you know, and drink our beers and whatever. And it was a happy place.
Now, Jacques, as I mentioned earlier, it opened in 1938. It was also owned by Henry Vera, the same man who opened Punch Bowl. And during World War II, so from the early 40s on, it was known as a headquarters for female impersonators. It was well known to have drag shows and female impersonators at that time. Did you have experience with going to Jacques at that time as well?
I went to Jacques a couple of times, and yes, that's very true. Both times I went, there were drag queens. Totally different than today's drag queens, but they were really very entertaining. They all did shows. They lip sync. You know, most of them, they all did Judy Garland. And of course, they had to do Judy Garland. And it was good. The other place was the Napoleon Club. And it's really funny because the Napoleon Club, we used to call the Napoleon Club the Wrinkle Room because it was all really old gays, like I am now. I would be very, very perfect for the Napoleon Club now. But then, you know, in my 20s or just turning 18, 19, 20, those were like gay people that I didn't want to have any association with. They were so old. But it was called the Wrinkle, and it was an older crowd. It was older gay men that frequented that particular bar. Do you know about the Napoleon Club?
I do. And by comparison, the Napoleon Club was a more elegant, upscale environment, more lavish, kind of like if you think about a formal white linen tablecloth restaurant, you know, and it was a piano bar primarily, right? That was their main claim to fame.
It was a piano bar. Just think of it as gilded gold and flocked velvet wallpaper, you know, that was sort of and candelabras. That was sort of like what it was like. It was definitely for an older, well-to-do, for the most part, gay clientele.
Now,
in the Punch Bowl, we had I don't know if you've heard of her. We had Sylvia Sidney. Have you heard of Sylvia Sidney?
I have.
So she was a drag queen, but completely outrageous. Not like, you know, she wasn't trying to be a glamorous woman. She was just like, out there. She really pushed the envelope. She would often come in with, she would wear a toilet seat cover around her neck, as a bejeweled toilet seat cover, and outlandish makeup. I mean, really extreme makeup. And she was caustic. I mean, she could slice and dice you with 10 words, just cut you to bits. And she was fabulous. I mean, she was an icon and very, very entertaining.
My understanding is that after the Punch Bowl closed and she had moved on and actually performed at Jacques Cabaret for quite a while as well.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Yeah.
My understanding is that she was associated with them. Now, Napoleon Club, oddly, from what I've been able to dig up in history, they opened in 1929 and operated as what was called a chartered club throughout the Prohibition. So they were open during the Prohibition. And then
so it was a speakeasy.
Yeah. And then kind of evolved into the upscale, gay, lavish club. And it was open, oddly, 7 days a week from 5 o'clock in the afternoon until 2 a.m. So every day of the week you can go there.
Yeah. So you filling in, you can, because of your research, you've been able to fill in a lot of the gaps. And I'm just telling you, you know, from my own personal experience as a gay man at that particular time in Boston. The other thing I wanted to mention is there was, after the Punch Bowl, you know, we would go to Hayes Bickford, but then also we would go to Ken's in Copley Square. That was another place that everybody would go after the bars. It was, you know, Ken's was a regular restaurant, so there were a lot of straight people there, too. They always seated the gay boys upstairs. There was two floors, and the gay boys were always seated upstairs, and the straight crowd was always seated downstairs.
So the straight people didn't have to walk by a group.
Really good restaurant. I mean, great food and everything.
Now, was Jacques a fancy restaurant or fancy bar, or was it pretty plain also, other than the entertainment?
I remember it as being fairly plain. Nothing really, nothing compared to the Napoleon Club.
Yeah, and the one odd thing, and I've yet to find another one that exceeds it. I believe Jacques may be the longest running gay bar in a single location owned by a single family in the United States. They are wow. still operating today, and it's been 8 years.
Jacques is still open today?
It is. Oh, and this year, they will be celebrating their 84th year in business.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Now, you also mentioned the Vega family. And what other, do they have bars in other cities, gay bars in other cities?
They did. It's the Vera family, V-A-R-A.
Vera, okay. And where were their other gay bars?
Well, Henry Vera was the patriarch of the family, and he opened up the Punch Bowl, Jacques. He owned a bar that wasn't gay in Boston that was called the Sugar Shack. It was a jazz club. Okay. In P-Town, he owned Crown and Anchor.
Oh, he owned the Crown and Anchor?
They owned that until this past November. They just sold that bar. So it's still a gay bar, but they sold it last year.
You don't have to tell me about P-Town, because I grew up 2 hours from P-Town and went there since I was a little boy. My parents would take me. We would go to P-Town sometimes just because it was, you know, at that point, they didn't know anything about gay. It was considered an artist colony. But I spent many summers in P-Town. And up until recently, I would go every summer for 6 weeks to P-Town. So I've spent many, many, many times. But I have to tell you a side of story for P-Town. The first time I ever went to P-Town as a gay man, me and my 13-year-old friend, we were already in college. We were befriended by these. It was actually our parents' hairdresser who was gay and his lover. And they took us under their wing. And they took us to P-Town as gay men, gay boys, we were boys, for the first time. And we stayed at the Moors in P-Town. Now, the Moors at that time was a place where after the beach, everybody would gather. All the gay boys would gather. And you would wear these outrageous hats. And there we would see Waylon Flowers and Madam would perform at that bar during the day. It was an afternoon thing. And it was a raucous, raucous, raucous time. People would drink and they would sing along and Madam would be doing her stuff. And so it was the Moors. And then there was a place called the Madeira Club in Provincetown, where I saw Ruth Busby, Lily Tomlin, Charles Pierce, all perform there.
It's got quite a history. P-Town does. Yeah. Now, you had asked about other Vera bars. In fact, they own a couple of straight bars still in Boston. There's one that's a restaurant bar called Our House East. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that they own several bars that were in Kenmore Square called Narcissus, Lipstick, and Celebration. Mm-hmm. And then in Atlanta, which is where I encountered the Vera family, they own Backstreet, which operated for 30 years as a multi-level disco.
I went to Backstreet a lot when I have friends in Atlanta, so I went to Backstreet a lot back in the day.
That was a Vera bar. They also owned Levita's, which was a show bar. Weekends, which is where RuPaul got his start dancing as a go-go boy on a stage riser. Weekends Warehouse and Lipstick.
And let me ask you about the Vera family. Were they Italian or Portuguese?
I believe they're Italian, but I'm not sure. I believe they are. Carmine was the Carmine and Henry Jr.
They had to be Italian with the name.
Were the sons of Henry, and they eventually took over the Boston bars when Henry passed away. And then Carmine was the one who moved to Atlanta and opened up Backstreet, Levita's, Weekends Warehouse, Lipsticks. And then they also opened, they had three bars in Fort Lauderdale that I'm aware of. One was called Backstreet. One was called Auntie Mame's. and one was called The Electric Cowboy.
Don't know any of those. The only ones I know in Fort Lauderdale were the Marlin Beach Hotel and the Copa.
Yeah, those are great bars too. So the Veras have had a long history, connected to the gay bar business in several cities. And they had some great bars. Obviously, if Jacques could last 84 years.
That's amazing. Absolutely. I mean, that just blows my mind. It's incredible. And it's great that you have that history and you have that factoid. I mean, it's wonderful.
Well, that's kind of the whole concept of this project, is to record these histories, because so many people recorded the stories of the riots and the uprisings and all this other stuff, and they've ignored the bars, which made us the community that we are. They allowed us to meet like-minded people, to form organizations, to develop, civil rights movements and pride parades, and all these things came out of the bar scene.
Absolutely. Now,
another bar that you may know of in Boston, it was after your time living there, but the Jacques became, after the 60s, it kind of evolved into a women's bar, and it became more well known for its lesbian clientele. And then it became full blown traditional drag gay bar. So at that time, the Vera saw an opportunity to serve the gay women's community in Boston. And right across the street, they opened a bar called The Other Side.
The Other Side?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was a Vera bar as well. It was open, I think, for about 15 years or so. But it was another bar that they owned that is important in the gay community. So they've had a pretty good experience with gay bars. And as I mentioned, Backstreet in Atlanta, they opened in 1975. So that's when Carmen left Boston and I guess left Henry Jr., his brother, to run the bars up in Boston. And Carmen came down and opened Backstreet in Atlanta. And that had a phenomenal 30-year run, at least half of which was as a 24-hour nightclub. They had a special license in the city of Atlanta that they could serve liquor any hour of the day, any day of the week. They never closed. So no matter what time of the day it was, you could stumble into Backstreet and get a cocktail.
Yeah, I remember. Well, they used to have in Atlanta, I don't know if you knew about this, when they used to have the raft race in Atlanta in the 80s, where you would float down the Chattahoochee River. It was like a circuit party, pre-circuit party, and it was called Hotlanta.
I remember that. Hotlanta River Expo is what they called it.
Say again?
Hotlanta River Expo.
Right. I used 2 years in a row on that. And Backstreet, and then there was another one. I don't think they owned it, but there was a bar called The Cove in Atlanta.
That also had a 24-hour liquor license.
That place was out of time and space. You got every conceivable gay affinity person in there. I mean, you would get black drag queens, black hustlers, prostitutes, gay boys, older guys, whatever. And it was really a sleazy, sleazy bar. And you had to be really kind of twisted and chemmed up to go in there. but it was amazing. It was an amazing bar.
Yes, I remember it well. I lived in Atlanta from 1983 till 1998. And I visited the Cove and the Armory and Backstreet and many of the other bars. At one time when I lived there in the 80s, there were at least 30 gay bars operating in Atlanta at the same time. It was a very, very open.
Amazing in the 80s. Did you ever do raft race?
I did several times.
Oh, okay. Great. Oh, so you know. All right. Well, I was very good friends with Tom Johnson, who was the DJ from Atlanta. He moved to, I was living in LA. I moved to LA, but he moved from Atlanta to LA. So I would go and I would stay with him. And then I would stay at the Colony Square Hotel, of course, when I would come for raft race and do all that stuff.
The Colony Square was quite the treat. For those who don't know, the Colony Square was a mid-century style kind of hotel, motel, actually, that was directly across the street from Back Street. You could literally walk out the front door of the hotel, cross Peachtree Street, go up the side of the building, and enter Back Street at the back alley. So it was right there. It was partially owned by Doris Day. She was one of the owners of the cabana. And it was very popular with the gay clientele. I still remember those kind of reproduction Roman statues lining the walkway.
I remember. That's right.
And if I'm not mistaken, they had a restaurant there called La Copa Cabana or the something like that.
I remember the restaurant. I don't know what the name was, but I ate there. But, you know, I went to Gay Pride in Atlanta 2 years ago, and I stayed with a friend who lives in Atlanta. And we were walking, and I saw this hotel, and I said, oh, this is a nice hotel. He says, that used to be the Colony Square Hotel. It looked so different to me, I don't know, from when I remember the Colony Square Hotel. But is it still called the Colony Square Hotel?
No, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think they may have knocked the building down and built a new building there. I'm not sure the building still stands, but no, it's not. It hasn't been the cabana for quite a while.
Okay, yeah. Well, Raft Race was incredible. That was another major sort of gay event. You know, you would go down the Chattahoochee River and there'd be drag queens on floats or drag queens under the bridge and, the water cannons and all of that stuff. And then the big circuit party at either the railroad station, wherever they had, and they had parties all weekend long. It was just a major event, for sure.
Yeah, it was. It was huge. And as I recall, it was in August, in the heat of the summer. So it was like 95 degrees and very humid in Atlanta, which inspired all the guys that were there to have the absolute minimum amount of clothing possible.
That's right.
And you would even go into the clubs at night, like Back Street, which had a monstrous dance floor. And you would see nothing but skin from wall to wall because every single guy in there was wearing a pair of gym shorts, tennis shoes, and that's it.
Or Daisy Dukes they were wearing. Yeah.
And if you recall, especially on those events, we used to joke that it was raining inside of Backstreet because all the humidity from everybody sweating on the dance floor would go up into the ceiling and then it would drip back down. So you would have a rain on the dance floor.
That's what happened when they had the dance at the railroad station. It was so humid that it started raining. And Tom Johnston, who was the DJ, he was mixing and somebody had to hold an umbrella over him, a big golf umbrella over him and over the mixer so that, you know, he wouldn't get electrocuted or wouldn't short out because it was actually raining in the depot.
Yeah. There's some crazy times we had back then. I certainly missed them. I came out later than you did, obviously. My first gay bar experience was in the late 70s, 77. So I'm about 14, 15 years behind you. But
yeah, well, I think 64 was when I came out. Well, it was my friend. We came out to each other young. But I actually came out in terms of going to a gay bar for the first time, it was in 64. Like I said, the Punch Bowl was the first gay bar that I went to. And from there on in, you know, that's it, you know.
And I'm sure, even though we're talking about something that happened almost 60 years ago, we're talking about 58 years ago, even though it happened so long ago, that memory is etched in your mind because it was a turning point in your life to know that you were not alone. It was not you and one other person on the whole planet that had these weird feelings that you were not going to get married and have kids or you were going to be having sex with another man. It made you know that there were more people like you out there, and they were so important to us for that reason.
It totally validated me as a human being. And slowly but surely, any shame I had associated with being gay. I mean, I was never really the one that was saying, oh, I don't want to be gay, I don't want to be gay. I never really remember having those feelings. I just had a feeling of isolation that, you know, there weren't others like me. I wouldn't say I was proud. That didn't really happen until after Stonewall, but it was I finally had a sense, like you had said, a sense of community and like-minded people, and also being in gay bars and seeing them, all different stripes, I realized that they were just regular Joes, just normal, you know, except for their sexuality, just as normal as anybody else in terms of how they presented themselves and who they were. They weren't these pedophiles and perverts and, you know, demons that the society had made them out to be. So that did a lot to lift all that shame-based stuff off of me. And then, you know, it was the 60s, too. And I moved to San Francisco at the end of 66, and I lived in the Haight-Ashbury. I became a major hippie. I was right there at Ground Zero. And after Stonewall, you know, I became a major activist.
Yeah, there was a lot of activists that came out of that era from the, you know, late 60s into the late 70s, early 80s. Once the AIDS crisis hit, that kind of regenerated a lot more. But
That totally galvanized the community. And you know what? I'll just subvert a little bit. Also, you know what the AIDS crisis did? There was a lot of separation prior to the AIDS crisis between the gay women's community and the gay men's community. You know, there was all these, like, this disdain. They were separate, maybe equal in terms of they were, you know, homosexual, but they were equal. But once AIDS happened, the lesbians really stepped up to help out. And I think that really changed and brought those two communities together like they had never been before.
I have heard that numerous times, including an interview I recently did with Gina Gatta. Do you know Gina from San Francisco?
Yeah.
The owner of the Dameron Company, she said the same thing. She had two gay brothers, and she was involved in the gay scene, I guess, going back to the 70s in San Francisco. And she said the same thing, that the AIDS crisis really galvanized the participation between the lesbians and the gay men. And I think on top of that, too, in the late 70s, we had the disco movement, which also kind of changed the face of the gay community, because in the previous decades, a lot of the bars were very segregated. They would tend to be, you know, white male leather bars, or, you know, black male dance clubs, or lesbian bars. But when the disco era came, everybody seemed to be attracted, and most cities only had one or two discos, so that naturally helped homogenize and get people together. And then, of course, the AIDS crisis, the community saw as a common threat to the entire community, and and that brought us together even more. So there are a lot of things that happened in that time frame that changed the face of our community.
Absolutely. You put it very, very succinctly. That's really how it was. But still there was, you know, I remember when I was living in L.A., and this was in the 70s. And the Bar Studio One in West Hollywood, right?
Absolutely.
So they would do things, though. Okay, if you came in and you were white, you know, you would have to show ID at the door. But if you came in and you were either a woman or black, you had to show like three pieces of ID. Women, they always checked. You can't come in with open-toed shoes, stuff like that. So it took a while for that to sort of come together, too. There was, you know, a little bit of racism and misogyny there as well.
I heard that. I did a couple of interviews with people from Studio One, including two guys who are in the process of they're involved in the development of a movie called Studio One Forever.
You're kidding.
No, it's come. It's in production. It's in post production right now, I believe. But yeah, Gary Steinberg and Lloyd Coleman are two of the producers of the movie, and I interviewed them in length about the bar. And also, the very first bartender for the back lot at Studio One, his name is Gary Mortimer, and I interviewed him as well. And the general impression I got is that part of that conflict about them being biased or whatever is somewhat blown out of proportion, because my understanding is that Scott Forbes, who is the main owner of Studio One, he also had a couple of business partners. And one of his business partners, one of the owners of Studio One, was Black.
Right.
And Scott Forbes' boyfriend was an Australian Aborigine.
Right. So yeah, I knew Scott. Scott happened, Studio One was the major bar in West Hollywood, but then, and then I became very, very involved with Pro in LA, Hollywood. Pro became the disco. Pro was like the LA version. It couldn't be equated at all like the Saint. It was, you know, it was a late night club, and it stayed open until 6-7 o'clock in the morning.
I've heard stories about Probe as well. So there were definitely some great bars out there. We had
a group on Facebook called, you should probably check it out, called Friends of Probe. And it's all the pre-probers, and all there's lots of stories about Probe and Greg's Blue Dot Lounge that you would really be interested in.
Yeah, I think I am a member there.
Oh, are you? Okay.
I think so.
Why am I not surprised?
I try to join as many of the groups as I can.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people in those groups also belong to my Gabe Archives group, and they will share the stories there as well. So.
Okay, great.
We try to get the word out. That's the point of this history, is to be able to have people share it with other people. You know, it doesn't do any good for me to write down the history and put it under my pillow. And the point is for everybody to...
One person you need to contact, and he's on Facebook. He's a very dear friend. He used to be my roommate in North Hollywood. His Charity Charles. He's a drag queen. He has been a drag queen. He is the second oldest living Miss Fire Island. He goes way back. He's a Boston boy, and he has many, many stories about Boston and New York back in the day. And he would be a wonderful resource for you.
I will definitely look him up.
Charity Charles is his name on Facebook. Tell him you spoke to me and that you did this interview, this podcast. And I'm sure he would be more than happy. He has some wonderful stories to tell, being a drag queen for all these years.
I will definitely look into that and see what we can come up with. So okay. You lived in Boston, you moved to San Francisco, you lived in different cities, and now you are in sunny Florida.
And now I'm what?
In sunny Florida.
Right. I live in Fort Lauderdale. I've been here since 2000. I lived in LA from 75 with a little bit of a brief intermission in Colorado. I moved to Colorado. And then I moved back to L.A. And I lived in L.A. till 2000 and then moved here. I moved here to take care of my elderly parents, who at that time, my mom had Alzheimer's. My dad was a primary caretaker. They're both gone now. But I came back to take care of them. And I knew Fort Lauderdale coming from New York and Boston, because I used to come down for spring break. And, you know, those are the days of the Marlin Beach Hotel and the Copa. So... I had friends who would also, I'm retired. I had friends who were also down here and retired. And I've been ensconced here since 2000.
Yeah, and fortunately, not too far from where you are, right there on the edge of Wilton Manors, is the Stonewall National Museum and Archives.
That's
which
right.
is one of the most accessible gay archives in the country. there are a number of archival projects, but a lot of them are buried inside the bureaucracy of a university or behind hidden doors somewhere. But the Stonewall operates as a walk in the front door, you know, grab a book off the shelf type library, as well as having a lot of memorabilia and ephemera from bars all over the country.
Absolutely. It is a wonderful place to go and just sit and look at the stuff and take it out and read it. I've donated. I used to save all my invitations, disco invitations, to some of the major parties and stuff. So I gave them a bunch of stuff that I donated to them for some of the invitations. You know, I was a disco maniac, I can put it that way. I mean, I'm a dancer. I love to dance. So I used to save all this stuff. And I still have some of it, but some of the major ones, like a lot of the Saint stuff and everything, I gave to them so that they would have it for their ephemera and all of that.
Well, good. I appreciate you, you know, taking time out of your day to tell us about some of the bars, especially in Boston from the 60s and 70s, because those are stories that are going to get lost forever before long. And
I appreciate you and all that you're doing. And also, I have stories about bars in New York, too, because I moved to New York. I lived in New York. I went to graduate school in New York. So back in the day, too, in the 60s, and then I would come to New York. So I have a few stories. If you want to interview me at some point, feel free.
Oh, absolutely. We will definitely revisit that, and we'll talk to you about some of the other cities and capture some more stories from other bars. But thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I have to applaud you for doing what you're doing. I think it's fantastic.
That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode or to find more episodes, visit gaybarchives.com.